Hello and welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's face-to-face with video series, in which we invite respected authors, speakers, teachers and researchers in the conscious community to share the stories behind the 10 books which influenced them the most on their life journey. And joining me today on our first live streaming episode is Matthew Mackay, PhD, who is many things: a poet whose poetry has appeared in more than 60 literary magazines, a professor of psychology at the Wright Institute in Berkeley, an author of more than 30 professional psychology and self-help books, which have sold more than 3 million copies, a publisher. He co-founded the self-help publishing house New Harbinger, and most importantly, I think he'd agree with me on this, a father who embarked on a long journey in search of ways to communicate with his murdered son, Jordan, which resulted in two riveting and revelatory books: Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe, and The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife, Jordan's Message to the Living on What to Expect After Death, which I hope we'll hear a bit more about later. Matthew Mackay, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew, thank you for joining us. Reading your bio, which includes the fact that you were clinical director of Haight-Ashbury Psychological Services in San Francisco for 25 years and co-founder of the Bay Area Trauma Recovery Clinic, which serves low-income clients, and currently director of the Berkeley CBT Clinic, I'm especially glad that you made time in your schedule to share your 10 best spiritual books with us. So tell us first, how did you find this task?
Well, it required me to look at what excites me most, most influenced me, was most revelatory for getting a sense of a cosmology of what the spirit world looks like. And I think many of the books that I was drawn to and that got into my top 10 list are books that, you know, provide knowledge and information about what lies beyond death. That really is fascinating to me. It's a deep and primary interest. And the first book that I ever read that gave me any kind of insight was Michael, the book Journey of Souls, Michael Newton's book, and also some of his other work. And The Destiny of Souls being one of them. And I think what drew me to that book was that he is a psychologist, was a psychologist like I am. He does hypnotherapy as I do. And he had stumbled accidentally onto this method for learning about the life between lives, a regression process that he was surprised to find. And you know, he worked with 7,000 people before he wrote his books, and he did not prep them. He did not tell them what to expect in the afterlife. And yet virtually all of them reported similar places, stations, experiences, structures in the afterlife. It's uncanny how much agreement these people had, these 7,000 subjects. And that just kind of exploded in my mind. It seemed very compelling to me. And the more I read, the more fascinated I became. And I've been a skeptic. I've been an agnostic most of my life, grew up as a Catholic, and kind of threw all that away and just said, I don't know. And yet what he showed, what he revealed, was so powerful, and it felt right. You know, it had that gong that goes up and goes off inside of you that says you've just encountered truth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was I just experienced, oh my God, this is telling me what I've always sort of thought or sort of known or sort of felt, but never had words for, and never believed I'd have any possible way of knowing for sure or any direct knowledge of this. And here it is right in front of me. So that was my introduction. I probably read that book, I don't know, 15 or more years ago. And it was profound, and it really set me on a spiritual path. I learned how to do the regression that Newton pioneered, and I've done it many, many times. And I've had the experience of witnessing people go enter the afterlife and be there and report back what they're seeing and experiencing. And it's so profound. And then I later had the experience, Ralph Messner, who's a well-known psychologist and researcher on afterlife experiences, did a similar regression for me. And I had that experience. And it's so profound. And it's so life-changing that I do enjoy providing that for others.
I don't think there's anyone who isn't curious about, you know, what happens when we leave this place. You know, just about everybody I know is curious about it, even if they've got no belief whatsoever. Did you come across this particular book before you lost your son or afterwards? Before you lost your son? So you'd already started on this path.
I had started to get really fascinated with what the afterlife might be. And in fact, you know, in life, when Jordan and I would talk about that, he thought it was baloney. And he thought I'd a screw loose to be really interested in that. And then, of course, as it turns out, he dies and comes back and connects to me and reveals more than I ever could have imagined. It's very paradoxical, really.
Yes, absolutely. So number two on your list is Life Before Life by Jim Tucker. And you actually did squeeze an extra one in there, I noticed. Children Who Remember Previous Lives by Ian Stevenson. And I'll let you have that extra one because Tucker was a protege of Ian Stevenson.
Right. Well, that meant a lot to me. I think I started looking at those maybe 10 years ago or so. And I feel like, I guess, you know, I'm a scientist. I've done a lot of research in psychotherapy and psychotherapy methods and using, you know, scientific methods to investigate things. So I'm drawn to things that do satisfy some of the requirements of a scientific investigation or study. And Ian Stevenson's work with more than 3,000 young children who spontaneously remembered past lives is extraordinary because he's, quote unquote, was able to solve the case in about 800 or 900 cases. He was able to actually find out who this person was in a previous, they described enough about their previous life, their name, their location, the house they lived in, and so forth, family members. And they described enough that he could solve it and actually locate who this person had been in their previous personality. And all of the things in about 800 or 900 cases that they described turned out to be accurate and correct. I mean, that's mind blowing. I mean, and to me, it's very powerful evidence. It's hard to explain that in any other way than they actually had memories of a past life. It was also very interesting, by the way, that most of his subjects had died violently, suddenly or violently. And it seems like that's something that makes it possible for some of that past life knowledge and those memories to leak through into the present life. It's not always the case, but very frequently the case that there was a violent and sudden end. And so there's something about that that was very interesting to me as well. Stevenson's work, Tucker's, you know, popularizing and summarizing his work meant a lot to me because, again, it added more evidence. And in the same way, Journey of Souls, you know, provides what I feel like is substantial evidence of 7,000 people who don't, or are naive and don't know what to expect, describe the same thing. Here we have 800 or 900 kids who describe a world that they know nothing about, a life they know nothing about, meaning they've never had any connection to that life. And yet they're describing perfectly who they were and what they did and who their family was. Extraordinary.
Yeah, I thought so too when I read those books. Number three is The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment by Thaddeus Gollas.
Yeah.
You said he did a lot of acid.
Yes, Thaddeus was, a lot of his insights came from hallucinogens, which is interesting to me because I generally don't think that altered states are necessarily helpful. I think they sometimes distort the information we get from the other side. And of course, a lot of channeling over the years, you know, going back thousands of years, people who channeled typically did so in altered states. And I think that's why the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Egyptian Book of the Dead have a lot of distorted images in them, because they were channeled with drugs, essentially. And but that's an aside. I think Thaddeus Gollas, I read that, oh God, I don't know, 40 years ago, maybe even more. And it really, it was another one of those, that gong that goes off of truth. It's like the way he described love is as the foundational element that actually creates our vibrational level. And then our vibrational level is entirely dependent on how much love we can hold. And that our physical life is often at a pretty low vibrational level that makes us vulnerable to pain, vulnerable to damage, and that as we move, as we vibrate at higher levels through full expression of love, we become less and less damaged by pain and by the slings and arrows of circumstance. It made so much sense to me. And I think it just became a fundamental sense of what I think life is about. It's about finding love. And it's about finding love in the face of pain. And all that, that idea is echoed by Jordan in what he's channeled to me. And I felt that set me on a course of understanding what was really core, like what is responsible for our vibrational level, and it's love.
Yeah. Number four is one that really fascinates me, and I'm sure it fascinates many people. Induced After Death Communication by Alan Botkin. So how do you induce it?
Yeah, and I read that before Jordan died, but I was fascinated with it. It was because, again, I'm a psychologist, and I specialize in treating trauma. And Alan Botkin is a psychologist who also specialized in treating trauma at the VA in Chicago. And he was working, if it's okay, I'll just tell this little story about how he discovered induced after-death communication, IDC. He's working with a vet who had befriended a child in Vietnam, a nine-year-old named Lee. And they became very close, very deep relationship, and he planned to adopt her. And at some point, she stepped on a mine and he lost her. She died in his arms. And he just had years of profound grief over that. It changed his life. And so he came to Botkin for trauma work. And Botkin made a small, and Botkin did EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which I do with clients. He made a small mistake in the variation in the actual protocol, a small variation. And this man closed his eyes and had a full communication from Lee. She was there. She was in front of him. He could see her. He could hear her. She had lots of things to say. And all of this occurred in the space of less than a minute, maybe. And
well, it looks like we've lost connection with our guest. We've had a lot of technical issues going on today. So are you back with us?
I'm here.
Good, good. You completely disappeared then.
I know, there's something strange happening. So anyway, to make a long story short, Botkin did this with 83 people at the VA who had profound grief experience, traumatic grief. He didn't tell them what to expect. As far as they knew, they're just getting straight EMDR to work on trauma. 81 of them had this experience without having any prep or expectation of having it, where they, and it's, in some cases they saw, in some cases they heard, in some cases both, in some cases they had kinesthetic, even sensory touch experiences of the loved one. So it's really a very powerful thing, you know. And so after Jordan died, I did journey to Chicago. I saw Botkin, and I had that experience. I heard Jordan as clearly as I did when we sat in the kitchen talking in life. And he had very important things to say to me that were very healing. I could feel the grief shifting inside of me. I can actually feel teary as I talk about it, because it was such a profound experience of actually, for the first time after he died, knowing he was there, knowing he was still watching over us, that his love was still present in our lives. Very, very powerful experience. And so I have done that. I do work with grief and traumatic grief. And I've done a number of those IADC experiences with clients, and to watch it and watch how profoundly they change. It's just, it's a beautiful, beautiful experience, even just to observe, let alone to have happen to you.
Is this something we can all learn, or does it have to be facilitated?
It has to be facilitated. It's not hard. The process is pretty easy, actually, and it's not a big jump from traditional EMDR. But it is something, as far as I know, one would need to facilitate. Although there's now some very compelling evidence that you can do EMDR yourself. So it may be that it's something you could translate into a process that you could do for yourself, with yourself.
So did you have to be trained to do it?
No, I read his book, and in the back of the book is instructions for how to do it. But because I know how to do EMDR, it wasn't, there's no leap there for me. I can see exactly what the modification was in the protocol.
A lot of people will be buying that book.
It's a beautiful book. The stories in it are just so inspiring, and it just see the relief. And it's sort of like the same thing as near death experiences. When people have near death experiences, it changes profoundly their sense of the universe, of what's there, and of sort of the eternal nature of a soul's life. And this is the same kind of thing. It's like you suddenly have your own evidence, your own experience, that we go past death, and that souls who have died are still there. We can still reach them. They can still reach us. I mean,
Well, later I would like to talk to you a little bit more about some of the things that Jordan told you, because, you know, they're things that we all need to hear. But let's move through the list first. Number 5, A Theory of Everything by Ken Wilber. What was it about that book that you particularly enjoyed?
See, that book is about the evolution of consciousness. It's a roadmap of where we're going, where we started in terms of when souls first started incarnating here. I don't know if it's a map for all of the planets on which souls incarnate, but at least in terms of what we know about here, it really maps out these steps or stages in the evolution of consciousness, moving from just survival consciousness, just my focus is entirely on what can I eat, where can I get shelter, how can I avoid danger, all that. And then we kind of move into up several steps, and we get into a kind of consciousness that's focused on tribalism, on my interest is just those people, my tribe, my family, the people I know, and the interconnection and supportiveness of that. And eventually and we, you know, we move toward through various levels of consciousness that involves scientific development and technology and so forth, and then we move toward awareness of all, of the connectedness to all, and we can see and understand what's going on in our culture right now by looking at the evolution of consciousness, and that people who have different memes and different levels of consciousness are living all at the same time and are colliding with each other in terms of how they understand and see the world. The people who are tribal are all about nationalism and my country and screw everybody else. They're not people. The willingness to have war to one tribe to prey on another, all of that kind of mentality. I'll take what's mine and I don't care about you. All of that. And then we can see people who are more evolved and further along the development of consciousness, who are aware of the needs of all, of the experience of all, and that that's a crucial part of how they understand and see the world, that they are a part of everything, as opposed to just an individual surviving, or my tribe, or my company, or what, something I've built. All of that are more primitive forms of consciousness, and we're moving, and more and more people are representing these more advanced stages of consciousness, which gives me a lot of hope and optimism about ultimately where we're going to go. And one of the things that sort of is evidence for that is that in the history of the world, violence keeps dropping. Now, it doesn't seem like that, but when you look at any given era, but the data is very powerful. That the level of violence and the experience of an individual's likelihood of experiencing violence is going down steadily over the eras, and that's because of the evolution of consciousness.
Yeah.
And so, anyways, it's a lovely concept, and I felt like I could see the world through a different lens now, and I could see who is representing certain memes or levels of consciousness, yeah, and why they're that way, and more acceptance of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a hard time with Trump supporters, but honestly, when I look at where they are in terms of the level of kind of the meme that they represent, it all makes sense. How they see the world makes total sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we have to learn to have tolerance for how other people see the world, mm-hmm, to a degree.
We need to learn to talk to them. We need to learn to appreciate that there's something of value in their perspective.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that Wilbur talks about. It's not just we discard the old meme and it's gone. It's that there is always some kernel of value and truth in each of these memes. And we have to kind of bring that with us into the next meme.
Yeah. And it's important for us to understand.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Number 6 is a book that comes up several times. You probably aren't surprised by that. Over and again, people put it in their list, The Untethered Soul, Michael Singer. Yeah.
I love that book because it talks about how to get into the seat of awareness, and really what the nature of consciousness is. Consciousness, we are not our thoughts, we are not our emotions, we're not our sensations and the sensory experience. We are the observer self, and being able to observe and watch all of that without being it, without getting caught, and getting caught in it is really where a lot of the pain comes from.
Yeah.
And identifying with our thoughts and our perceptions of experience, instead of just noticing that this is a thought, this is a passing experience. There, we have 60,000 thoughts a day. There's some very interesting research on emotions. The average emotion lasts less than 7 minutes. And the only way we could get stuck at the top of an emotional wave is we ruminate.
Looks like we've lost connection again, but I'm sure Matt will be back any second now. It's been that kind of day, I'm afraid. The eclipse, Mercury retrograde, there's a lot of energy moving through the planet right now. There you are again.
I'm just fascinated with Singer because he shows us that all of these things that we think are important and we identify with our thoughts, our feelings, and so forth, are just passing experiences that we can observe rather than be caught in and overwhelmed by. And a lot of our pain is not realizing that, not realizing the temporary nature of all of these experiences and getting into the seat of the word. So anyway, I find, and a lot of singers work, I will say, I'm very proud to say that my publishing company publishes The Untethered Soul. I shouldn't give it a plug,
of course you can.
The book means so much to me, and I'm proud that we were able to do it. And it's something that has made me glad to be a publisher, to be able to bring it up like that. Anyway, so singers very proud. And you know, there's a whole branch of psychotherapy called acceptance and commitment therapy, which I do a lot of, which comes out of that basic idea that we stop, you know, we don't have to identify with our thoughts and our feelings. We can just observe and watch them. And then instead of getting caught in them and being driven by them, we can actually act on our core spiritual values, which I think is a beautiful kind of therapy.
Well, I'm glad that you publish the books you love. You know, I think that's the only reason to publish books. So number 7, The Life Cycle of the Human Soul by Ralph Metzner.
Well, I love that book, and I knew Ralph very well. I worked with him, and he taught me how to channel, which changed my life, which gave me access to Jordan and Jordan's wisdom that I could never have had before. He also did a regression where I could experience past lives and look at the life between lives. So I felt like, you know, he gave me so much. But his book, The Life Cycle of the Soul, is sort of a summary of what he had learned in his research about the whole incarnational process, starting with all experiences we have in the womb, some of the trauma, Stan Grof's work about some of the trauma that occurs in utero, some birth trauma, and how that kind of sets us on a trajectory that sometimes is completely unconscious and we don't have full awareness of. And looking at that, very, very beautiful work. Many years ago, when I was learning hypnosis, I worked with a man named David Cheek, who was really one of the major figures in hypnosis, and he hypnotized me back to my birth, and which I never would have imagined was possible. It made no sense, but I could see it happening. And what was really fascinating was my whole body started twisting in one direction, which I didn't even understand what that was about. And Cheek, who was a gynecologist, said, "Oh, well, that's, you know, every baby has to turn one way or the other when they are born, being born." And so it was a very powerful experience that all those memories live in their body. They live in your consciousness. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is access them. Anyways, so Metzger is talking about how powerful that is and what an effect that can have on us when we don't even fully know or are fully aware of it. And then he really does talk about a lot about the death process and what that's about. He had a whole divination that he used, which I experienced, that he did with me, of actually entering the process of death and experiencing it. Very powerful experience. And so his thought was, it's really important for us to be open to the death experience and not resisting it, but prepare for it, which actually ended up having, I think, a lot to do with the book that Jordan just channeled to me, The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife, in the sense that preparing for death was something that he thinks we need to do. And Ralph had been doing for years and did with me. And then of course he looks at the afterlife and what goes on there, which is tremendously interesting to me, the choices we make for the next incarnation, how that works, what we're learning, what we're doing in the afterlife. So anyway, the book was very meaningful because I knew Ralph. I love Ralph. He gave me tools that really changed my life, and his work, I think, is very profound in terms of showing us, you know, the life cycle of a soul.
Mm. Yeah, we should all know that. Number 8, Lessons from the Light, Kenneth Ring.
Well, yeah, what I loved about that book was that he did some very interesting research on the effects of near-death experiences, not just what they are and recounting them, and, you know, like, you know, in Life Between, and Life After Life, the original book on near-death experiences, but not just recounting them, but actually doing some research to show how it affects people, and how profoundly people change, and the very positive psychological, emotional, and spiritual effects of a near-death experience. I mean, I love the stories; they're very compelling. I remember this one story that I've always carried, is a story of this woman who has a heart attack. It was up in Seattle. She has a heart attack, goes to the hospital, and is unconscious for quite a period of time. While she's unconscious, she leaves her body, and she's actually wandering around the hospital, and she's up in the top of the ceiling of the room she was in, and she can actually look down on the light fixtures and see the labels and stuff that you couldn't see from the room. It's only see from the top. And then she's wandering around and she wanders outside and looks out a window and sees down below on a rooftop below a set of sneakers that have been thrown there. Well, there's no way she could have ever, she was never in that location. She could never have seen those shoes. The only way she could have had that experience is if she left her body, if consciousness can leave the body and it goes somewhere else. And so his work to me shows that consciousness can leave the body, that is not dependent on the body. And when we finally learn that and experience that ourselves, it profoundly changes our sense of who we are, why we're here, and what we can expect in the afterlife. So it's really beautiful. I really appreciate his work.
Number 9, The Gratitude Project by Will Pye.
Yeah. Well, you know, I really, that book really meant something to me because I think it didn't remind me, it actually taught me how important the experience of gratitude is for mental health and spiritual health. And not just, you know, not just gratitude because, oh, I got some money in the bank, I got a job, but gratitude for existing, gratitude for being able to be a sentient creature that can observe, feel, and know, and learn, and even gratitude for the pain, because it's part of what teaches us. And virtually everything that happens, even the difficult, even the challenging, even the painful, can be an opportunity for gratitude, because we're getting to experience it, and there's some lesson in every part of that experience. And I don't know, for me, and the other thing that he talks a lot about is noticing and paying attention, not just, you know, having a passing, oh yeah, that was good, or that was nice, or, you know, I'm glad for that, but actually, you know, becoming fully conscious of the things that we appreciate. And so I feel, and he has some meditations that I think are beautiful that I use and I have my clients use. So I felt that was had a very powerful effect on me. And I think it's a message that is of great value.
Very important message for sure. Number 10, Handbook of the Afterlife, Pamela Ray Heath and John Klimmer.
Well, this kind of goes back to what I was saying at the very beginning of our conversation, that I'm just fascinated by the afterlife and getting a sense of
Okay, so we'll just wait a few minutes and Matt will be back.
Oh, you're well.
This is a great cliffhanger.
About, you know, what the afterlife, the mediums, the psychics, Madame Blavatsky. I mean, there have been countless, Jane Roberts and Seth, and there are countless people who have helped us have some sense of the afterlife, including going way back to Egyptian and Tibetan Boots of the Dead, Books of the Dead, the Upanishads. I mean, there are lots of places we've gotten information about the afterlife. But channeling is how most of this information comes to us. And so their summary of sort of the history of channeling, but what we've learned, what are the key and consistent messages that have come through from all these channels, all these different sources. Fascinating to me, but I didn't read it. I didn't want to look at it until after I'd finished channeling Jordan's Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife, his own book on the dead, essentially, because I felt like I didn't want it to contaminate what I was. But what was so cool about the book is it was really, in many ways, verifying lots and lots of what Jordan said. So it felt like it supported and gave credence to the things he was saying. So anyway, that book is important to me because it really made me feel more confident in the veracity and truth of what I was getting from Jordan.
So those books would you say that they were condensed into a much shorter period for you, rather than books that you'd read, as a young man that inspired you? These came much later and closer together.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, well, I read The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment when I was in my 20s. I'm in my 70s now. So, I mean, I read it a long time ago. But the other books are probably in the last 15 years, I would say. Because my spiritual evolution really kind of started when I read Michael Newton's book. I think that was really a very powerful initiation into instead of just having a hope that there was something out there, having a very concrete idea of what was out there. And that really kickstarted for me a lot of my spiritual journey, I think.
I would imagine that it, this is not really for me to say because I don't know, but I would imagine that when you did lose Jordan, there was a smidgen of comfort because you had this knowledge, you had read that book, and there was a possibility, he wasn't just maybe completely gone. I mean, am I right? Or
yeah, no, it gave me hope. I could go back to my knowledge of that book, and also that I'd done some of these regressions myself with people, and seen what or heard what they described. So I had hope, but I had this compelling drive to actually connect to Jordan. I mean, it was just this singular focus that took over my life in some way, and kept leading me to seek him in various ways. I did it through mediums and through shamanic exercises, and then I again eventually went to see Botkin and have an induced after death communication. I also through Metzner had experiences where I could visit the afterlife and actually make contact with Jordan there through that kind of induction. And then finally, of course, learning to channel. So all of these things were part of this evolution of moving toward and trying to reach out to Jordan. And finally, when I learned to channel and I started actually having conversations with him, it was, first of all, it was the most beautiful relief. Like, this relationship continues. We can still do this. The love between us is as every bit as real and as alive as it was when Jordan was in life, was physically here. And Jordan seemed very interested in telling me, as much as I wanted to hear or absorb, about the world he lived in, about what's important, about why we incarnate to begin with, why do we enter a physical world. I mean, he was just teaching me, and he seemed willing and wanting to. And in fact, when the first book came up, I had no intention or any idea that I was going to write a book. Seeking Jordan was just, he said, okay, we're going to write a book, Dad, essentially. Still calls me Dad, even though we've had many lifetimes. In other lifetimes, we've had very different relationships. But he said, we outlined the whole book in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, every chapter, exactly what was going to be in it. So here's what we're going to do. This is the thing. And he decided to write it. And I'm, of course, delighted. It's something we can do together. It's a project. And I also got to tell the story about seeking him and finding him. Something very similar happened with this book, The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife. He said to me that, you know, we need to help people with the fear of death, and we need to help them prepare for death. And we need to give them a picture of the afterlife that's going to make them hopeful and confident rather than scared and avoidant. So it was his idea again, and he outlined it in a very few minutes. And then I guess over a couple of years, we worked through all of what he felt needed to be in the book. And this book is 100% channeled from him, other than just the appendices and introduction. So it really is what he wanted people to know about. And I feel like I'm just the person that conveys this. I'm the scribe of providing knowledge that he's wanting people to have.
Wow, fascinating. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes left. Would you tell us what are the most important things that Jordan wants us to know?
Well, first of all, that the most important preparation for death is love. And, you know, he has a little, there are many meditations in the book or things you can do to prepare for death. But one of the ones that's the simplest is you breathe in fear and, you breathe in love and you breathe out fear. Breathe in love, breathe out fear. And actually, the more you're able to love both the people in your life and the people who are gone, and hold on to that love for the people who are gone, and expect to see them and expect that their love will be present for you when you die. That the awareness of all of that is the most important preparation you can do for death. Because he says that love is the medium of communication in the afterlife. And if you are not tuned to love, instead you're dealing with a lot of painful residuals from your life, anger, you know, fear, avarice, greed, whatever you're struggling with in life, violence. If that's what you're kind of bringing with you to the afterlife, I mean, that you have to go through a lot of work, healing work, before you can fully join spirit world. And so the work we can do now is to prepare with focusing on as much love as we can, not only for those who are with us and around us in our lives, but those who are gone, and that love will be there for us and with us as we make our transition. So that's one of the most important things that he talks about. I mean, he has a lot of things to say about what the afterlife is, all the different experiences and parts of it. Basically, the afterlife is a giant school where we're learning constantly. A lot of reviewing of the Akashic record, learning about our past life, learning about other past lives, learning about cause and effect. When you do this, certain things happen. It changes. And one of the interesting things about the Akashic record, I'll just say, there's so many things that we could talk about, but is that we can actually go into the Akashic record when we're in the afterlife, and we can study, if I had done this instead of that, what would have happened? And we can see a whole chain of events that we can actually watch them as if we were watching a video of all of the effects over time of how that other decision would have played out. And then when we close the book of the Akashic record, that becomes a null life. It's just a possible but not actual life. And so we do a lot of studying and learning there, so that each time we come back for an incarnation, we're a little more prepared, we're a little more ready to do the work that we have here, our lesson plan here, which is only possible because this is a place where there's pain. Most of what we're learning is because there's pain here. There are things that we can't learn in the afterlife because there isn't any pain. So the pain here is very noble and important. It's not just something that, oh my God, I've got to avoid that, or it's a failure if I've had pain. No, the pain is actually something that's teaching us. And we come here because that pain is really the only way we can learn certain lessons. And the key lesson, of course, is how do I love in the face of pain?
Pain, Not and become a victim to it.
Not become a victim to it, but to learn from it. Pain is always teaching us. And that's what we're here for. We're here to learn. We're here to evolve and grow and take everything that we learned back to the whole, back to all there is. So we're little learning machines. We're little units of learning. And that's what we come, that's what we do. And then we come back and upload it to all. And consciousness continues to evolve. All evolves. God evolves, if you want to call it, because we're all God. And it continues to evolve because we're evolving, and we bring everything we learn back to the collective consciousness. And that's our job. That's our role as souls. And the pain is a vital part of what teaches us and what we learn. So those are some of the things that Jordan talks about. And of course, there's a lot of very specific things about what the afterlife is like, and how we select new lives, and how incarnation is part of the karmic learning cycles that we go through. So yeah, that's.
Is he going to write any more books?
He wants to write a book that he wants to call "What Is Real," and it's kind of an exploration of the nature of reality. You know, because, you know, basically a lot of non-dual traditions are really claiming that everything we experience is kind of an illusion. We're all one. We're not, even our separateness is an illusion. Everything we experience in the world is an illusion. And Jordan is really saying that's not true. All there is, or collective consciousness, creates matter and creates these experiences. And they're real in that sense. And as soon as collective consciousness would forget about it, stop thinking about it, it would stop being. But it's real because the energy of thought creates this universe that we interact with. And then we go out into that universe, as these little souls go out into the universe and experience it in a very profound way. And we learn from it and bring that back. And so there's a way that... this is beautiful and noble basis to our lives. It's not just, you know, some getting plopped here and stuck in whatever life or family or era or struggle that happens to surround us. We're here to learn, and we're here to grow and evolve, and then to take all of that back, so that all of consciousness can grow and evolve as well.
Well, I think we're pretty much out of time now, sadly, Matt. But we'll have to have another conversation another time about those books. I'd like to delve a bit deeper into them. But thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your 10 best list with us.
I've so much enjoyed it. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you.
Us too. So thank you, everybody. If you want to know more about Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe and the Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife, Jordan's Message to the Living on What to Expect After Death, then you can go to the website seekingjordan.com. And if you want to be the first to be notified of these events and new 10 best spiritual book lists as they get added to our website, you can sign up for our newsletter at the No BS Spiritual Book Club. com. You can also download audio versions of each episode to listen at your leisure on Om Times Radio, iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and many other podcast sites. That's it for today. Thank you for being with us, and I hope you'll join me live at the same time next week. Until then, it's goodbye from me.